And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, Halloween has come and gone. The Day of the Dead has come and gone. And I haven't heard of any Halloween murders. Though we do have monsters running around. They're actually running for office. Well, it's November the 2nd. 306th day of the year. Leap year is 307th. 59 days remain until the end of the year. And on this date in history, in 619, Agagan of the Western Turkic Khaganate is assassinated in a Chinese palace by Eastern Turkish rivals after the approval of Tang Emperor Gaozu. 1410, the Peace of Basseterre, this suspends hostilities in the Armagnac-Burgundian Civil War. Plymouth Colony Governor Josiah Winslow leads a colonial militia against the Narragansett during the King Philip's War. Now, the King Philip's War, sometimes called the First Indian War, Metacom's War, Metacomet's War, but Metacomet's Rebellion or Metacom's Rebellion, it was an armed conflict. It broke out in 1675, lasted through 1678. It's between the indigenous inhabitants of New England, the New England colonists and their indigenous allies. The war is named for Metacom, or the Wampanoag chief, who adopted the name Philip because of the friendly relations between his father, Massasoit, and the Mayflower Pilgrims. This war continued in the most northern reaches of New England until the signing of the Treaty of Casco Bay in April 1678. It was, like so many others, result of greed. 1795, the French Directory, a five-man revolutionary government, is created. You know, whenever there's revolts like that, there's always a small group that seizes power. 1868, time zone. New Zealand officially adopts the standard time to be observed nationally. And I might make mention, on the November the 1st, we went back an hour. It's caused a lot of confusion. 1889, North Dakota and South Dakota admitted as the 39th and 40th U.S. states. 1899, the Boers begin their 118-day siege of British-held Ladysmith during the Second Boer War. 1912, the Bulgaria defeats the Ottoman Empire in the Battle of Lule-Burgas, the bloodiest battle of the First Balkan War. That opens up the way to Constantinople. 1914, during World War I, the Russian Empire declares war on the Ottoman Empire, and the Dardanelles are subsequently closed. 1917, the Balfour Declaration proclaims British support for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, with the clear understanding that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities. In other words, we're going to come in and we're going to set up the Jewish homeland, but everybody else is going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Now, as Balfour said, trust us. We're from the government. 1917, the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet, in charge of preparation and carrying out the Russian Revolution, holds its first meeting. 1920, in the U.S., KDKA of Pittsburgh starts broadcasting as the first commercial radio station. This first broadcast is a result of the 1920 United States presidential election. 1936, the British Broadcasting Corporation initiates the BBC television service, which is the world's first regular high-definition service. That was defined as at least 200 lines. Renamed BBC One in 1964, that channel still runs to this day. 1940, the first day of the Battle of Elia Kalamas between the Greeks and the Italians. 1947, a California designer, Howard Hughes, performs the maiden and the only flight of the huge H-4 Hercules, also known as the Spruce Goose, the largest fixed-wing aircraft ever built. It was made of wood, I understand, and it still sits. After that first flight, it never flew again. 1949, the Dutch-Indonesian Roundtable Conference ends with the Netherlands agreeing to transfer sovereignty of the Dutch East Indies to the United States of Indonesia. 1951, 6,000 British troops arrive in Suez after the Egyptian government abrogates the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty of 1936. 1951, Canada in the Korean War. Platoon of the Royal Canadian Regiment defends a vital area against a full battalion of Chinese troops in the Battle of Songkhla Spur. Engagement lasts into the early hours of the next day. 1956, Hungarian Revolution. Imre Nagy requests UN aid for Hungary. Nikita Khrushchev meets with the leaders of other communist countries to seek their advice on the situation in Hungary, selecting Janos Kadar as the country's next leader on the advice of Joseph Broz Tito. 1956, Israel occupies the Gaza Strip. It was known as the Suez Crisis. 1959, quiz show scandals. 21 game show contestant Charles Van Dorn admits to a congressional committee he'd been given answers, the questions and the answers in advance. In other words, nothing was sacred. The game shows were rigged. 1959, first section of the M1 motorway, the first interurban motorway in the UK, is opened between the present junctions 5 and 18, along with the M10 motorway and M45 motorway. 1960, Penguin Books is found not guilty of obscenity in the trial of R versus Penguin Books Limited. And it was all about the Lady Chatterley's Lovers book. 1963, South Vietnamese President Diem is assassinated following a military coup. Can't trust anybody, not even your own officers. 1964, King Saud of Saudi Arabia is deposed by a family coup, replaced by his half-brother Faisal. 1965, Norman Morrison, a 31-year-old Quaker, sets himself on fire in front of the river entrance to the Pentagon to protest the use of napalm in the Vietnam War. Now, I don't know what you may think, but clearly, this man was a sandwich or two short of a full picnic. You're going to protest the use of fire by setting yourself on fire. I got a problem with that. In 1966, the Cuban Adjustment Act comes into force. Allows 123,000 Cubans the opportunity to apply for permanent residence in the U.S. 1967, Vietnam War. President Lyndon Johnson and the wise men conclude the American people should be given more optimistic reports on the progress of the war. Don't tell them the truth. Tell them what we know they want to hear. 1983, President Ronald Reagan signs a bill creating Martin Luther King Jr. Day. 1984, capital punishment. Thelma Barfield becomes the first woman executed in the U.S. since 1962. Now, for those that are not familiar with that name, she was an American serial killer who was convicted of one murder, but eventually confessed to six. And also the first woman to be executed by lethal injection. Born in South Carolina. Rural South Carolina, and that's about as rural as you get. Raised near Fayetteville, North Carolina. Father was reportedly physically abusive, and her mother, Lillian Bullard, didn't intervene. She escaped by marrying Thomas Burke in 1949. Now, she was born 1932, so she was 17. Couple had two children, reportedly quite happy till Barfield had a hysterectomy and developed back pain. And this led to a behavioral change and eventual drug addiction to painkillers. Burke began to drink, and Barfield's complaints turned into bitter arguments. On April 4th, 1969, Burke passed out from drinking. Barfield and the children left the house, and when they came back, they found the house had burned to the ground, and Burke was dead. 1970, Barfield married a widower, Jennings Barfield. Less than a year after their marriage, Jennings died on March 22, 1971, from heart complications. In 74, Lillian Bullard, Barfield's mother, showed symptoms of intense diarrhea and vomiting and nausea. She recovered a few days later. During Christmas season of the same year, Bullard experienced the same earlier symptoms. Died in the hospital a few hours after being admitted on December 30th. Well, she, as I say, she was accused and confessed to killing six, was found guilty of one, and was imprisoned in Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. That was an area for escape-prone prisoners, mentally ill prisoners. Since there's no designated area for women under death sentence, and she was the state's only female death row inmate. During her stay, she became a devout Christian. She spent her last years ministering to prisoners, for which she got the praise of Billy Graham. In fact, there was an attempt to obtain a commutation to life imprisonment to keep her from being executed. Well, you have to wonder, what was the right and wrong in this situation? 1986, Lebanon hostage crisis. U.S. hostage Jacob Jacobson is released from Beirut after 17 months in captivity. 1988, the Morris Worm, the first internet-distributed computer worm to gain significant mainstream media attention, is launched from MIT. 1990, British satellite broadcast against Sky TV merged to form BSkyB as a result of massive financial losses. 1999, the Xerox murders. In the worst mass murder in the history of Hawaii, a gunman shoots eight people in his workplace, kills seven of them. Happened November 2nd, 1999, in a Xerox Corporation building in Honolulu. Service technician Brian Koji Yulizugi shot at eight, wounded seven fatally, six co-workers and his supervisor. He, at 8 o'clock in the morning, he opened fire inside the building with a semi-automatic pistol. Killed his supervisor and six co-workers and tried to shoot another one. The eighth person escaped without injury. After the shooting, he fled in the company van. By mid-morning, he was found sitting in the van near the Hawaii Nature Center in Makiki, held a police standoff with police that lasted 5 hours, during which he brandished a pistol at police, read magazines, and smoked cigarettes. And to add to the situation, at that same time, the Hawaii Nature Center was hosting 35 local school children who were trapped inside without food or water. He finally surrendered about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Hawaii time. The victims are Jason Balatico, 33, Ford Kanahira, 41, Ronald Kakaoka, 50, Ronald Kamamiya, 54, Melvin Lee, 58, Peter Mark, 46, and John Sakamoto, 36. Well, he, Brian complained he had a poking sensation in his head that started when he went to work for Xerox. And then he began making unfounded accusations of harassment and product tampering against fellow repairmen. He was ostracized, of course, by other workers, which didn't help matters. And eventually, he pulled a gun. 2000, Expedition 1 arrived at the International Space Station for the first long-duration stay on board. 2016, the Chicago Cubs defeat the Cleveland Indians in the World Series, ending the longest Major League Baseball championship drought, 108 years. Yeah, a lot of births and deaths on this date. Holidays, Christian Feast Day, Agapius and Companions, Daniel Payne in the Lutheran Church, Dominius in Vienna, Erk of Slain in Ireland, Justice of Trieste, Victorinus of Patal. Earliest day on which Election Day can fall. November 8th is the latest, which is held on the first Tuesday following the first Monday in November, which means Election Day will be tomorrow. All Souls Day in the Roman Catholic Church and Anglican Communion. Coronation of the Haile Selassie in Rastafari. Day of the Dead. It's the second day of the Day of the Dead. El Dia de los Muertos celebration in Mexico. Desidia in Belarus. Indian Arrival Day in Mauritius. International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists internationally. And Statehood Day in North and South Dakota. Yeah, let's see if there's anything else worth discussing. Okay. 1875, Verne Cameroon reaches Benguela from Angola, from Africa's east coast, the first European to cross Equatorial Africa. 1930, coronation of Rastafari Makonnen as Haile Selassie I. He was the 225th emperor of the Ethiopian Solomonic dynasty. Supposedly, that royal line was founded by the illegitimate son of Solomon with the Queen of Sheba. 1949, another was recognized as its former colony, Indonesia, as a sovereign state. Let's see if there's anything else of interest. In 1898, cheerleading began in the U.S. Johnny Campbell leads the crowd cheering on the football team at the University of Minnesota. Famous birthdays, Marie Antoinette in 1755, James K. Polk in 1795, Warren Harding, 1865, Aga Khan III, 1877, Burt Lancaster, 1913. Then in 1932, the Great Emu War began. You won't find much about this in your history books. Australian soldiers armed with Lewis guns, that was the early machine guns, sought to cull the emu population over crop destruction in the Campion district in Western Australia.
Motion detected at the front door.
All right. Famous deaths. George Bernard Shaw in 1950. Diem in Vietnam, 1963. Willie Sutton, 1980. For those who don't remember Willie Sutton, during his 40-year criminal career, he stole over $2 million. Spent more than half his life in prison. But he escaped three times. And then Zayed bin Sultan al-Nahyan on this date in 2004. See if there's anything else. I just got an email asking me for more information on the Day of the Dead. It's a traditional Mexican holiday celebrated November 2nd. On this day, it's believed the souls of the dead return to visit their living family members. Many people celebrate this day by visiting the grave of the deceased loved ones and setting up altars with their favorite food, drink, and photos. Now, the ancient indigenous people of Mexico had practiced this particular custom. for about 3,000 years. Celebration is now known as Day of the Dead. Originally landed on the 9th month of the Aztec calendar and was reserved for the entire month. In the 20th century, the month-long festivities were condensed to 3 days called the Day of the Dead. Halloween on October 31st, Day of the Innocents on November 1st, and Day of the Dead on November the 2nd. La Catrina is one of the most recognizable figures of the Day of the Dead, towering female skeleton of vibrant makeup and flamboyant feathery hat. Well, all that having been said, we will now go back to talking about the murder of Mary Fagan that we haven't finished yet. Well, the governor, as I said, Governor Slayton, whose firm merged with the defense attorney's firm, Murillo Frank, was accused of the murder of 14-year-old Mary Fagan, primarily based on the fact he was Jewish. And the police, having had to arrest and release three or four different people, and even coached one to lie, and he admitted he lied, so they kept having him make new statements to cover up the previous lies. Well, based upon all the problems that showed up in the trial, Governor Slayton commuted Frank's death sentence to life imprisonment on Monday, June 21st, 1915. In response to the governor's actions, Atlanta Mayor Jimmy Woodward commented to the press that the larger part of the population believes that Frank is guilty and the commutation was a mistake. Well, the public was outraged over Slayton's actions, and a mob threatened to attack the governor at his own home. A detachment of the Georgia National Guard, county policemen, and a group of Slayton's friends who had been sworn in as deputies came in to disperse the mob. And for his own protection, Leo Frank was moved to Millersville State Penitentiary in the middle of the night. Now, keep in mind that it's long been believed the motivating force behind all this public uproar was the DA's office, because they had a vested interest in seeing Leo Frank executed. Otherwise, they had to admit that the Atlanta Police Department was just totally incompetent. Now, on July 17th, the New York Times reported that a fellow inmate by the name of William Green tried to kill Leo Frank by slashing his throat with a 7-inch butcher knife. And when questioned, the attacker told authorities he wanted to keep the other inmates safe from mob violence, and Frank's presence was a disgrace to the prison, and he was sure he'd be pardoned if he killed Frank. Now, my question: where did this nut job get a 7-inch butcher knife in prison? June 21st, 1915, commutation of Frank's sentence provoked Tom Watson into advocating for Frank's lynching. He claimed that lynch law was a good sign, as it showed that a sense of justice still lived among the people. In response, a group of 28 prominent men, and we're talking men with money and position, organized themselves in what was called the Knights of Mary Fagan. Now, these 28 possessed various skills, from an electrician to a lay preacher, and they openly planned to break Frank out of prison and lynch him. Now, the ringleaders of this group were very well known. However, such as the clannishness and secrecy in the state of Georgia, this list wasn't published until the year 2000, when Mary Fagan's great niece, Mary Fagan Keene, posted a list on the web. Among those on the list were Joseph Mackey Brown, former governor of Georgia, Eugene Herbert Clay, former mayor of Marietta and later president of the Georgia Senate, E. Dobbs, mayor of Marietta at the time, Moultrie McKinney Sessions, lawyer and banker, part of the Marietta delegation at Governor Slayton's clemency hearing, and several current and former Cobb County sheriffs and a number of other prominent civic leaders. These people openly advocated the murder of a man who had gotten a kangaroo court to find him guilty of a crime simply because of his ethnic background. There was no evidence against him.
except the lies of the janitor, and it was shown that they were lies. On the afternoon of August 16th, 8 cars carrying the lynch mob left Marietta for Milledgeville. They got to the prison about 10 p.m. The member of the mob that was an electrician cut the phone wires leading into the prison, and other members drained the gasoline from the prison's automobiles, handcuffed the warden, and took Frank from his cell in his nightshirt and drove away. Now, the almost 7-hour trip back to Milledgeville from Atlanta was carried out on back roads. Top speed of the cars in those days was estimated to be about 20 miles an hour, with lookouts stationed in each small town they had to pass to make sure there was no interference. Now, the lynch mob stopped at a place called Frey's Gin. It's about 2 miles east of Marietta, which is not that far from Atlanta. The site had already been prepared with a rope and a table furnished by former Sheriff William Frey. Frank was handcuffed, his legs tied at the ankles. He immediately hung from a branch of a tree at about 7 a.m. Now, the lynching was not a great secret, as was shown with the number of prominent people who were present, according to the Atlanta Journal. They even had newspaper coverage. According to the story, a crowd of men, women, and children arrived on foot, in cars, and on horseback to watch. Souvenir hunters even cut away pieces of Frank's nightshirt. According to a New York Times story, Robert E. Howell, a relative of Clark Howell, editor of the Atlanta Constitution, tried to whip up the mob to cut the body into pieces, burn it, and then bury the remains. Judge Newt Morris, yes, there was a judge present, tried to restore order and asked for a vote on whether the body should be returned to the parents intact. Well, after all was said and done, a grand jury was impaneled to indict the lynch mob. But nobody could be, but nobody testifies to the identity of the members. I mean, it was real well known, and they were written up in the paper. So, as a result of a clear case of murder, nobody was punished since it had all been done for a good cause. That is very typical of justice in Georgia. Good cause is whatever they seem to think it is. This was a clear case of abuse of process and what amounted to a fixed trial. To make their case, officers suborned perjury, resorted to the third degree, and ignored the evidence to convict the man they knew was the killer. And how did they know he was the killer? He was Jewish. Leo Frank never saw justice while alive and is still denied justice today. The real killer escaped having to answer for his crimes. And Leo Frank had his rights totally ignored by the very people who swore to uphold the law. Well, let's turn from that travesty of our judicial system that you find in the state of Georgia and talk about the murder of Nora Fuller. It was 1902. The city was San Francisco, which even then was something of a melting pot for immigrants of all races and classes. It was also a time when many children are forced to forego what we'd call a normal childhood and enter the labor force doing whatever job they possibly could to earn a living. And such was the case of Eleanor Nora Fuller. Now, she was originally born in China. She was 15 years old that fateful year when she was forced to drop out of school to earn a living and help her mother and three siblings. Now, the previous year hadn't been an easy one for the little family. The parents had recently divorced, and the five of them were having to make it on just what the mother could bring in, which wasn't a great deal. For this reason,
motion detected at the front door.
Nora decided to help out. She'd wanted to try and make a go of it in the theater and made inquiries to an agency to try and find employment related to that field. But on January 8, 1902, another opportunity came her way that she just couldn't resist. Saw an advertisement in the San Francisco Chronicle that it wanted young white girl to take care of baby. Good home, good wages. Hoping to at least get an interview, Nora answered the ad and got a postcard in reply. Postcard instructed her to meet a man named John Bennett at the popular restaurant at 55 Geary Street at either 1 p.m. or 6 p.m. Well, on the day set for the meeting, which was January 11th, 1902, Nora left her home about 5 p.m. for her appointment. The next thing heard from the young woman was a phone call to her home that was answered by her 12-year-old brother. Nora informed him that she was at John Bennett's residence at 1500 Geary Street. She'd been offered a job of caring for the baby, and her employer wanted her to start at once. Well, at that point, Nora's mother came online and insisted she come home and start her job on Monday. Well, eventually, Nora agreed and hung up, and that was the last anybody heard from Nora. Even though Nora didn't come home that evening, as she had been instructed to do, surprisingly, her mother didn't report her as missing for several more days. Has to be said, though, that once she was reported as missing, the San Francisco police immediately went to work trying to find the young woman. Based on what Nora's mother told them, officers first went to the popular restaurant where Nora was to have had the meeting with John Bennett. Well, the owner of the restaurant, F.W. Crone, told officers that at about 5:30 on January 11th, a man had come to the counter to let him know he was expecting a young girl to come in looking for John Bennett, and the police sent her to his table. The man in question was recognized as a regular by both the owner as well as a longtime waiter. Nobody thought anything about the request. Meetings happened there all the time. In fact, upon more thorough questioning, both swore the man had been dining there regularly for at least a decade, though neither had known his name till that particular day, which, in my experience, is not unusual. The owner swore he hadn't seen the girl come into the restaurant, but he couldn't say she hadn't. He could say that John Bennett waited for about half an hour, after which he had gone outside and paced impatiently for a few more minutes before he left. John Bennett was described as being about 40 years old, of average height and weight, brown hair and a brown mustache. He presented a very smart, respectable appearance, so nobody thought anything was odd. The officers went to 1500 Geary Street, the address Nora had given her brother in a telephone call. They discovered it wasn't a valid address, it was merely a vacant lot. Since Nora had allegedly called her home from this address, the question now arose, had Nora lied, and if she did, why? For the next month, there was an extensive newspaper coverage regarding what had been called the Nora Fuller case. It splashed across the front pages of all the San Francisco papers, but in spite of a citywide manhunt, not a single trace of this young girl was ever turned up. In addition, there was absolutely no trace of the mysterious John Bennett ever found as well. But this was to change. On the afternoon of February 8th, 1902, H.E. Dean, an inspector and rent collector for a real estate firm of Umson and Company, entered a rented property located at 211 Sutter Street in San Francisco. The residence was locked up tight, and it was clear that nobody was at home, so Dean used a passkey to get inside. Now, entering by way of a passkey is not a normal practice, but the rent was due, and Umson and Company had been informed the tenant had moved out. So as far as they knew, the house was empty. The house had been rented only a month before to C.B. Hawkins, but all attempts to contact him had been in vain. And so it was that H.E. Dean was sent to check on things and find out what was going on in that house. As soon as he entered, Dean said he knew something wasn't right. Wasn't a stick of furniture on the entire first floor. He went from room to room to room and found there wasn't a single indication anybody had ever been there in some time. When he finished his inspection of the first floor, he slowly climbed the stairs to the second floor. Went slowly down that second floor hallway, checking each room that he came to, only to see that each room was empty. Finally noticed the door to one of the back bedrooms was closed tightly. Slowly, cautiously, he opened that closed door to see the room was in darkness, all the shades drawn down to the very bottom of the windows. He could just make out in the dim light there were pieces of clothing strewn about the floor of that room. Well, at that point, the feeling that something just wasn't right was so strong he didn't venture any further into that bedroom. Deciding that caution was the better part of valor, he pulled the door closed and retreated to the street and came back with Police Officer Gill. Together, they went back up the stairs and paused just outside that closed bedroom door. Both listened intently, but they couldn't hear anything. Taking the lead, Officer Gill cautiously entered that dimly lit bedroom, crossing to the closest window. raised the shade and turned toward the only piece of furniture in the room, a large bed. To his horror, lying spread eagle on the bed was a young girl. She was clearly dead. Her body was partially decomposed. At that point, Gil left the room and closed the door behind him. With Dean in tow, he left the house to summon detectives. After initial examination, it was determined the dead body was that of the missing Nora Fuller. And the evidence showed she had clearly been raped and strangled, and then her body had been savagely mutilated. Thorough search of the property revealed one towel, a mostly empty bottle of whiskey, the butt of a cigar, and several pieces of the junk mail addressed to Miss C.B. Hawkins of 221 Sutter Street. One of the pieces of the junk mail had been opened and stuffed in the pocket of Nora Fuller's jacket. Her purse was also found, but it contained neither money nor the postcard or the letter to meet John Bennett. Now, further investigation revealed the bed was secondhand and been bought the day after the house had been rented, as had the sheets and the pillows and the quilt. The bedding had been placed on the bed straight out of the packaging without the benefit of being laundered first. The only other furniture in the entire house was a single chair that had been purchased secondhand as well. Now, further forensic examination showed that Nora had some alcohol in her system, and the last thing she'd eaten was an apple, which had been eaten, it was estimated, about an hour or two before she died. Nora's mother said that Nora had been eating an apple just before setting out for her appointment. This, of course, led authorities to believe she'd been murdered almost immediately after she arrived at the house. Police believe that the man known as John Bennett and the man who rented the house as C.B. Hawkins were probably the same man. Canvas of secondhand shops in the area confirmed that a man fitting Bennett's description had purchased pieces of furniture and bedding only a few days before Nora disappeared. They all said that the deliveries were made to 221 Sutter Street. This information called into question initial assumption Nora had been killed immediately. Why go to all the trouble of renting a house and buying furniture? The plan was to kill her immediately. It just didn't make any sense. And if things were confusing enough, a friend of Nora's came forward with a new twist to the mystery. According to Madge Graham, Nora had been secretly dating an older man by the name of John Bennett for quite some time. Now remember, she was only 15. Madge went on to say she didn't even cover for Nora by telling Nora's mother she and Nora at the theater when in actuality Nora was out with Bennett. Madge also claimed that the ad for the nanny job was actually a ruse to fool Ms. Fuller into thinking that Nora was applying for a job as a nanny when she really intended to meet her much older boyfriend and spend some time with him. While the entire concept that Nora would go to the trouble and expense of placing an ad and answering it boggled the imagination, it would explain why Nora gave her brother a wrong address. Of course, the placing of the ad didn't tend to be an extreme method of getting time to meet a man, and ads weren't cheap by any means, even in 1902. So where did she get the money? Madge's story received some support when a grocer by the name of A. Minky came forward to reveal that Nora had come into his store to use the phone to call a nearby hotel when her family had a phone at home. It was believed that she was probably calling her mysterious older boyfriend. Now, the police were somewhat suspicious of Madge Graham's story. Nevertheless, then a new lead came to light that indirectly supported Madge's story. On January 18th, a week after Nora's disappearance and 3 weeks before her body was found, police had received a report that a man by the name of Charles Hadley, clerk at the San Francisco Examiner, had allegedly embezzled a large sum of money from his employers and vanished. Investigating this embezzlement case, the police talked to Hadley's girlfriend, Ollie Blazier. She had a few interesting things to say. She gave the police samples of Hadley's handwriting that bore marked resemblance not only to John Bennett's handwriting on the classified ad form he submitted to the San Francisco Chronicle, but also to the handwriting of C.B. Hawkins on the rental agreement for the house at 221 Sutter Street. So now the question became, was the missing Charles Hadley actually John Bennett as well as C.B. Hawkins? Now, Ollie Blazier told police that Hadley had a particular fondness for tenderloin. And this fact referenced information received from the owner of the restaurant that John Bennett would always order a porterhouse steak and then only eat the tenderloin portion. He also seemed oddly disturbed upon reading in the newspaper that Nora Fuller had been murdered and she'd been and that she had found blood on a few pieces of his clothing around the time it was believed that Nora had been murdered. She also added as an afterthought that though Hadley was clean-shaven, he sometimes wore a false mustache. That raises questions about why somebody would do that. Further investigation also revealed that Charles Hadley was actually Charles Start. He was wanted for another charge of embezzlement in Minneapolis in 1889, and he'd also allegedly raped another 15-year-old girl in San Francisco in 1900. So now the question became, who was Charles Start? And was he really the killer of 15-year-old Nora Fuller? Well, in spite of a nationwide manhunt, Hadley, or whatever his real name might be, was never found. This case leads to several questions that, as of yet, have never been answered. One, was the body on the bed really that of Nora Fuller? How did they tell? Especially if the body was partially decomposed. When and how did she actually die? And how long had the body on the bed been dead when her body was found? If John Bennett was Nora's boyfriend, why did he ask the owner of the restaurant to direct a girl that would ask for him to his table? And who was Nora calling at the nearby hotel from the grocery store? Well, even assuming Nora was planning to set up housekeeping with an unknown man, there was no proof that it was Hadley, or Bennett, or whatever his name may have been. This was a case for forensic evidence, if there ever was one. Of course, in 1902, the term forensic evidence wasn't even used. Well, many times you've heard, I'm sure, the expression, something to do with Little Lord Fauntleroy. Well, did you know that was actually a real individual? Or at least that's the name given to a real individual. On March 8th, 1921, the body of a young boy, estimated to be between 5 and 7 years old, was fished out of a pond near the O'Loughlin Stone Company by one John Burlick. Initial examination suggested a child had been killed by a blow to the head with a blunt object and been in the water for quite some time. It was also determined a child had brown eyes and blonde hair. And from his clothing, it was believed the child's parents had some money. Well, due to the child's apparel, the investigators called the boy Little Lord Fauntleroy. And since the assumption was that the boy's parents were affluent, it was assumed that this case would be quickly solved, at least insofar as determining the child's identity. But that wasn't to be the case. Though detailed descriptions of the dead child were immediately circulated, nobody came forward to claim the body. Police even displayed the body at the local funeral home for a number of days, but nobody appeared concerned about the child. Then a $1,000 reward was posted for any information about the boy's identity. But even with this inducement, nobody still came forward with any information. There was one clue. An employee of the O'Loughlin Stone Company reported that a couple had come to the business office a month before the child's body was found and asked if anybody had seen a little boy in the area. They seemed quite upset. And the man was seen to scan the area around the quarry carefully as though looking for something. Finally, the couple drove off and disappeared. The employee failed to get the license number, so it was impossible for authorities to track him down. There was speculation that the dead boy had been kidnapped for ransom. If this was the case, it was believed that the kidnappers may have told the parents that their child would be near the quarry. Of course, if this was the case, why didn't the parents go to the police? Then there was a report that the woman who had asked about the child had committed suicide by jumping into the quarry where the boy's body had been found. But in spite of rumors that this had taken place, a thorough search of the quarry by police revealed no woman's body and no evidence of any kind. Then there was a report that came from a man from Chicago by the name of J.B. Belson. He thought the child might be his nephew and the child might have been murdered by his sister's ex-husband. Police investigated this lead thoroughly before they made the decision. It led nowhere. A local woman from Waukesha by the name of Minnie Conrad raised money to bury the child and even took care of his grave till her own death. As an interesting side note, there have been numerous reports over the years another woman whose face was always concealed behind a veil would come and leave flowers on Little Lord Fauntleroy's grave. She's never been identified either. To date, the real identity of the dead child has never been determined. But I would suggest that with today's interest in genealogy and the DNA databases that are available, relatives could easily be found if anybody took the next step and perhaps exhumed the body to see if there was any DNA available. After 100 years, I don't know if there would be or not. Well, Atlanta, Georgia is the scene of our next story. It's been the scene of a lot of bloody murders. And with their idea of what justice is, a lot of murders by the state of people who are innocent of what they were accused of. But the story of the Atlanta Ripper is unusual in the length of time this killer has prowled the streets of this city without being apprehended. Interestingly, this case didn't receive much in the way of publicity outside the city as the victims of the fiend known as the Atlanta Ripper were members of the black community. Then as now, in the state of Georgia, issues in the black community tend to stay in the black community. Now, these killings actually appeared to have begun in the year 1909, but there's no clear evidence that attributed every one of these killings to the same individual. Actually, the police never really pursued the idea of the Atlanta Ripper, believing there was no such thing. It was made up. However, the circumstances of each killing seemed to show a decided relationship to each other, making it likely that it was, in fact, one person. The first killing that was probably committed by the individual referred to as the Atlanta Ripper took place in the year 1909. In April of that year, the body of Della Reed was discovered in a trash pile. September of that year, a female victim who's never been identified is pulled out of Peachtree Creek. She'd been stabbed and had her throat cut. The series of murders that many people feel were actually committed by the Atlanta Ripper continued through the year 1910. In addition to the two I've already mentioned, there were seven others, at least. Of course, researchers have argued that these seven murders may not have been committed by the Ripper since all but one was shot. They could have simply been the victims of the domestic violence or other circumstances that led to their murder. Certainly, it's not beyond the realm of possibility these women were, in fact, Ripper victims, but he simply changed his methods of killing. Many who have written about this time period have pointed to the clear institutionalized racism that existed in Atlanta, and it exists today as well. It's only 3 years before the first murder when there were massive race riots in Atlanta that left 25 African Americans were killed by white mobs following a series of accusations of raping white women. Now, many of these accusations later proved to be false, but they didn't bring back those killed during the riots of whatever color they may have been. It's also true during this time period, in spite of claims of tolerance and progress in Atlanta that were made by the mayor of Atlanta and the governor of Georgia, the Jim Crow laws were still on the books. Black voters still faced a poll tax that literally disenfranchised them, and police investigators generally paid little attention to crimes committed in the black community. The assumption was they were doing it to each other. It wasn't until 1910... yet it began to become clear to even the most myopic city leader that the evidence supported the idea there was a single individual who was committing these murders. A detailed study of the evidence, when prejudice was put aside, was that these murders all showed the hallmarks of a woman-hating psychopath in the vein of Jack the Ripper, who terrorized London in the 1880s. Now, the murder that seemed to gain the full attention of the Atlanta police took place October 3rd, 1910. That morning, the body of a 23-year-old cook by the name of Maggie Brooks was discovered. Her head had been bashed in with a rock or some other similar weapon. As time went on, it became clear to police this bashing in of the skull was a trademark for the murders that happened later. It was the trademark, so to speak, of the individual who became known as the Atlanta Ripper. Of course, at the time, police still hadn't come to understand that this was the work of a serial killer. When one looks at cases individually and not as a whole, patterns that are very hard to spot. And frankly, with the murder rate in the black community in the early 1900s, the Ripper could have started killing before 1909, but this fact would never be confirmed due to the desire of authorities not to open old wounds or further embarrass themselves for their failures to miss the signs of a serial killer. However, at the time, since there was no more unexplained murders of black women for the balance of the year, it was business as usual. Then on January 22, 1911, 35-year-old Rosa Trice was found with her skull caved in and her throat slashed. Evidence showed her body had been dragged to where it was found, only 100 yards from her own doorstep. In a typical myopic knee-jerk reaction, police immediately arrested her husband, John Trice, for the murder. Case closed. Well, that is until they had to release him for lack of evidence, that is. Well, in hindsight, Rosa Trice's murder became the template against which other Ripper murders were compared. The Ripper's modus operandi was approach a woman on the street, bash her in the head, and drag her body to a more secluded spot where he could take his time with her. Generally, this meant the victim was stabbed, mutilated before her throat was fatally slashed. Another popular action by the Ripper was to cut the women's shoes off their feet and take them with him. In early February, Lucinda McNeil was murdered with a straight razor. Immediately, there were those who believed the Ripper had struck again. But in typical fashion, police immediately arrested the husband based on some witness statements Lucinda had been killed by her husband in a drunken rage. Charles McNeil was tried and convicted of her murder, getting a life sentence in prison. Like finding a needle in a haystack, police were dealing with too many crimes to be able to get the big picture. Not that the murder of a black woman was given much attention. The next actual Ripper murder took place on February 18, 1911. Now, I would point out, every couple who's together for any length of time argues. And the mere fact that there are arguments and the wife is found dead doesn't automatically mean the husband did it. But in Atlanta, Georgia, when it's the black community, case closed. Well, this time, this February 18th, 1911 murder, scene of the crime was just past the Atlanta city limits, which meant the Atlanta police were not the primary investigative agency. It also meant they basically ignored this case. Be that as it may, the murdered woman, who's still unidentified to this day, appeared to be about 25 years old. Her skull was smashed in, though there was no mention in media reports of her throat being slashed. It's interesting to note the killer took his time with her, as there were empty beer bottles thrown around the body, so apparently he had a fine old time with her. April 5th, 1911, Georgia Brown was found dead. Since she was shot, not bashed in the head, most people don't believe she was a victim of the Atlanta murder. However, whether she was or wasn't will never be known, as her murder was never solved. Next murder was probably committed by this unknown killer. It took place May 27th, 1911. There had been a fairly lengthy period of time between the murders to this point. Something changed. The murder that took place on May 27th seemed to be the beginning of a series of crimes committed by this creature of the shadows. On May 27th, Mary Bell Walker was a cook. She was walking home from her job on this Saturday night and apparently came face to face with a mysterious Ripper. She was found dead the next morning, her throat slashed. On June 15th, the next victim was added to the list. Her name was Addie Watts. She was found with her skull smashed in with a brick. Her body had been drug into some shrubbery where she's beaten in the head with a train coupling pin. Then, as a final indignity, her throat was slashed. June 24th, another black woman by the name of Lizzie Watts was murdered. She'd been hit in the head, drug into some bushes, and throat had been slashed. I'm not able to confirm that Addie Watts and Lizzie Watts were related. Though the police maintained they had begun to suspect a serial killer at work, it appears it was an enterprising newspaper reporter who actually noticed the pattern. Until the paper started asking if there was a killer on the loose, the stories of the murder of black women, if they were reported at all, were related to the back pages with little detail. It was assumed the killings were simply the product of the degeneracy to be found in the black community, and certainly, initially, nobody in their right mind assumed that one person was committing these murders. In fact, in response to the suggestion that there was a single killer, so resistant were some authorities to the idea of one killer, it was claimed it was a convenient and fictional scapegoat for men to use to cover up the murder of their wives or girlfriends. Well, on July 1st, another attack took place. But the purported second victim of the night managed to survive and give a brief description of her attacker. This Saturday night, 20-year-old Emma Lou Sharp was sitting at home waiting for her mother to come back from the grocery store. Finally concerned it was taking her mother so long to return, Emma Lou began to walk to the grocery to see why her mother was so late. Emma Lou arrived at the grocery store and had to be told her mother had never been there. Well, with no idea what to do or where else to look for her mother, she decided to go home. On the way, she was approached in the street by a tall, broad-shouldered black man wearing a wide-brimmed hat. She was beside herself with worry, so she really wasn't paying attention when the man spoke to her. Asked her how she was feeling, she was baffled by the question, but said fine and tried to keep walking. But he stepped in front of her and blocked her path. Now concerned for her own safety, she tried to get around him, and as she brushed past him, she heard him say, "Don't be afraid, I never hurt girls like you." In the next breath, he had stabbed her in the back as he reached for her. Feeling the knife entering her back, she screamed at the top of her lungs and took off running as fast as she could, blood streaming down her back. Luckily, some neighbors heard her screams and came running to her assistance. The mysterious black man in the wide-brimmed hat stopped chasing her and seemingly vanished into the shadows from which he'd come. Well, her mother wasn't as lucky as Emma Lou. Neighbors who were searching for Emma Lou's attacker found her mother's body in some bushes. She'd been hit in the head and her throat had been slashed. July 10th, workmen on Atlanta Avenue noticed a trail of blood leading into a small gully. Deciding to follow the blood trail, they found the body of Sadie Holly. Her head had been bashed in with a rock, which was found lying nearby. Her throat had been slashed, and her shoes had been cut off her feet. Bloodhounds were brought in to try and track the killer, but they lost the scent after about 200 yards. The crime scene contained all the classic trademarks of the Atlanta Ripper, but police preferred to rely on the tried-and-true methods of solving crime. Find somebody to arrest. Anybody. It doesn't really matter. We'll come up with the evidence to convict him. Next day, they arrested a man by the name of Harry Huff and charged him with Sadie's murder. A witness claimed he had seen Huff with Sadie on the night of the murder and they'd been arguing. Additionally, police claimed that Huff had been found with dirt and blood on his clothes. So as a result of the witness's unsupported word, Huff was held on suspicion, eventually indicted, though it appeared that nobody, not even the police, really believed he was guilty. But police could now brag they had caught the killer, which removed some of the pressure on them from the leaders of the black community. At the same time as police arrested Henry Huff, they also arrested another man that witnesses said had been seen with Sadie. His name was Todd Henderson. Now, there were some sources that claimed that Emma Lou Sharp had identified Henderson as the man who'd stabbed her in the back, but others said that she couldn't be sure. And to put the icing on the cake, so to speak, police also arrested and indicted a third suspect, John Daniel. Though everybody was assured the killings were at an end with all the arrests, nobody was really confident the Atlanta Ripper had been caught. In spite of all the assurances, on August 31st, there was another murder that revealed the same trademarks as the earlier killings. The victim was 20-year-old Marianne Duncan. Her body was found lying on the railroad tracks from the west side of Atlanta. Her throat had been slashed and her shoes cut off her feet. October 31st, another victim was found. Now remember, we got three guys sitting in jail that the police were adamant were the killers. Her name was Eva Florence, and her head had been bashed in and her throat slashed. Everything about this murder screamed Ripper. And in November, another victim was discovered. Her name was Minnie Wise, and she was hit in the head with a rock, and her body was found dumped in a trash heap where two previous victims had been found. Her throat was slashed, and her right index finger cut off at the joint. Naturally, police immediately suspected her husband, Bud Wise, had killed her and simply made it look like a Ripper murder, but this was never proven. At this point, police would have arrested the Easter Bunny to keep from admitting there was a serial killer stalking the black community. And on that note, we're going to stop for today's show, and we'll come back and talk more about unsolved murders. But once again, until tomorrow, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.